Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today is a doctor who made a remarkable mid-career switch, which took her from a focus on the first moments of life to the last. She trained as a specialist in obstetrics. She has overseen literally thousands of births. But in recent years, she's given up maternity care in favour of a focus on the end of life. She's become a practitioner of medical assistance in dying, or MAID for short, the term used for Canada's programme of legalised euthanasia. Under Canadian law, it is legal for a qualified healthcare professional to end the life of an individual who wishes to die if they have a terminal illness or if they are in an advanced state of irreversible decline and have enduring and intolerable physical or psychological suffering. In 2021, more than 10,000 Canadians were assisted in their dying. That's 3% of all deaths, and a number higher than in any other country with a form of legalised euthanasia. So, has Canada made assisted dying too easy? Stephanie Green joins me now on the line from Victoria in Canada. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Dr. Green. Now, your particular focus for the last few years has been offering medical assistance in dying. What does that actually mean you do?
Mostly it means I talk to a lot of patients. I meet with families and patients who are interested in talking about their end-of-life choices, specifically about the possibility of an assisted death. I do a lot of education, a lot of informing patients what that is, what it isn't, what other options might be. We talk about the process, the procedure. There's a very rigorous process that needs to happen if they want to go down that path. So we work together through that process if necessary. And of course, ultimately for some, it's a matter of offering the procedure itself and actually administering the medications that will help somebody to end their life.
You were trained in obstetrics. You know, your work before all of this was with women about to give birth and delivering babies. In a sense, you were there at that moment of new life. Why did you choose to make this dramatic switch in your medical career to focus on the moments of death?
I'm actually trained as a family doctor, so everything from what we say is cradle to grave medicine. I did general practice for many years and always focused on maternity care. I've always had an interest in the intersection between medicine, ethics, and law, and I found I was able to find that through women's health, maternity care, reproductive rights, and I very much enjoyed my work. And I found, much to my surprise actually, that my 20 years working in maternity care really, really prepared me well for end of life. There's a similar skill set where you are dealing with families at one of the most intense days of their lives, a very emotional time in their lives, with a lot of family dynamics going on. And I'm there as a knowledgeable guide to help them through this incredibly intense and natural event. And all of those things can be said at the end of life as well. Why did I make that change? I wanted to be home a little bit more. I wanted to be around before my kids left. I was looking for a shift. And I'd been following the assisted dying debate in Canada for 30 years since I was in medical school. And I believe very, very strongly in patient autonomy and what we call patient-centered care. And I found that the idea of assisted dying was really focused on that, and I wondered who would do this work, and I felt that I could do this work, and the more I learned about it, the more I was drawn to it. So not a linear path.
You talk about your medical training. I mean, I just looked up the Hippocratic Oath, at least as it's expressed in the UK in doctors' training, and that oath, which of course all doctors have to swear to uphold, it reads, "I will use my power to help the sick to the best of my ability and judgment. I will abstain from harming or wronging any man or woman by it." I mean, your job is to carry around a bag of toxic poisons and administer them, you know, I'm not trying to be flippant, but administer them to people who are suffering grievously.
I think there's two words in that sentence that you used which are important. One is to help. I think the essence of what clinicians do is that we help our patients. We might do that in different ways. We cure sometimes, we care often, and we comfort always. I think helping patients is the essence of what we do. And then the other word, of course, is harm. I don't see myself as harming anybody. I think you can ask all of the patients and the families that I deal with. I'm actually helping them. them. I'm facilitating their final wish, their illness, their disease. That's what's harming them. That's what's killing them. I am there to help them at a time of great need. So I think it fits perfectly with what clinicians do.
It's plain that this is a hugely complex ethical and moral area, end of life and end of life care. Before we get into the details of the cases, which I'm fascinated to hear, I just wonder, when Pope Francis came to Canada in 2022 and he made a point of addressing the fact that Canada has the highest absolute number of euthanasia deaths in the whole world, he said this. He said, we need to learn how to listen to the pain, particularly of the poor and marginalized people. In place of affection, he said, in relation to Canada, he said, patients are administered death. Now, that was a message, in a sense, directed at people like you. How did you feel about that?
It's not the first time I've disagreed with something the Pope has said. I certainly don't take my directions from him. I don't mind that that is his impression. I take issue with that. I don't think that's at all what we do. I think we offer affection. I think we offer help. I think we offer caring and compassion. And we do it in a professional way within a structured, rigorous system with oversight. It's a legal framework. It's a rigorous framework. And I'm very proud of what I do. I think everyone can think what they wish, but that does not faze me.
So let's talk mechanics, if we may, Dr. Green. When you first come into contact with somebody who appears to fit the bill, you know, they want to die, and they explain to you the reasons why they want to die, how does the process work from that wish to die to the end point itself and your delivery of death?
Right. So every case is really individual. And that sounds a little bit, you know, flippant to say, but actually it's really true. So there's no standard path that anyone will take. But generally speaking, the process is that the patient needs to be the one to make the wish. Nobody else can ask for this on their behalf. So the patient expresses their wish in a written form. It's signed, it's dated, it's witnessed. It's an official form. Two clinicians need to see the patient separately and have an independent assessment to make sure they meet both the medical and legal criteria. As I mentioned, it's a very rigorous system. I'm not going to go through all the details with you, but there are approximately 8 or 9 things that need to be found to be true. The prime ones that I think that your audience might be interested in: the patient needs to make a voluntary request. They need to have the capacity to make this request. They need to have a what we call a grievous and irremediable condition and be suffering intolerably. A number of issues need to be found to be true. On top of that, there are a number of procedural safeguards that need to be met. And if all of that has happened, then it's a matter of empowering the patient and saying to them, you are eligible. That doesn't mean you're going to have an assisted death or that you must, but that you may. That in itself is therapeutic.
Is there an inbuilt time lag so that from the initial expression of wish through to the end, are there time restrictions or controls put in to ensure that the decision is fixed and that minds have not changed? How does that work?
Our original legislation required a very small, a 10-day reflective period from the time that the wish was made in writing until the event could happen. We found that was essentially a false safeguard. It was creating a lot of anxiety in our patients were very much close to the end of life and were concerned that they needed to retain capacity. They were refusing pain medications and refusing intervention in order to make sure that they stayed capable to make that final decision, which is another safeguard in our system. That 10-day wait has been removed from our law because it was found to be detrimental. So now we have two tracks. The first track, for those whose death is what we call reasonably foreseeable, there is no waiting period. They can make their wish and then go through the process, be found eligible, and then plan their death in whatever timeline works for them. For patients whose death is not reasonably foreseeable, what we call track two, there is a mandatory minimum, not so much a reflective period, but a minimum assessment period of 90 days to ensure that the assessment is fulsome. I find that very much a low bar. I find those cases can be very complicated and often will take months and months of time. Mm. But there is a minimum of 90 days for those whose death is not reasonably foreseeable.
Dr. Green, let me ask you a very blunt and personal question. What is it like for you, both emotionally and indeed physically, to be with the person at the time of their death and for you to be the person administering the lethal cocktail of drugs that kills them? You are killing them, unlike in certain situations like in California, countries in Europe, where what they call assisted suicide is allowed, where a medical professional can be present, but the person has to administer their own drugs. You are administering the lethal drugs. You are killing that person.
I was concerned when I began the work, wondered what that would be. But I, after some thought about it, after experiencing it, I have to tell you, the most accurate word I can tell you to describe what it's like to do this work is privileged. I feel incredibly privileged to be invited into that intimate time with a patient who's at generally at the end of their life, to be asked to facilitate their final wish, to be trusted in that time, to journey with them and witness their suffering and help them choreograph this very important event is, I find, very privileged work, and I have found it to be profoundly meaningful. People express a lot of gratitude for this possibility, a lot of relief that they can have an open and honest conversation. And I have been overwhelmed by the gratitude expressed by both patients and their families for this work.
That's a very powerful way of putting it. I just wonder whether at that last moment, as you were about to begin the administration of the drugs, have you ever had somebody say, I can't go through with this. This can't happen.
I've never seen that personally. I have had a significant amount of experience. In that time, I can think of two patients who changed their mind when I showed up. I give my patients a lot of opportunity to change their mind. They know that they're eligible to do that right up until that last moment that you describe. I have had two patients tell me when I arrived that they weren't ready and needed more time. One of them died that night on their own from other medical complications, and the other one called me back the next day and asked me to come as soon as possible. Other than that, I've not seen that personally. People do not enter this decision lightly. They do not come to me at the spur of a moment. They've often spent weeks or months already, or even years, thinking about this. They come to me when they're ready to make this choice, and they're often frustrated that the process takes time to go through. But I have not personally seen a lot of people changing their minds. But I find the patient is very much ready on the day of the event itself. They are very much at peace and kind of eager to move on. Mm. I find the family and friends are grieving, and it's very, very hard for them. That day is definitely harder for the loved ones than for the patient, in my experience.
As you've already alluded to in our conversation, there are somewhat different rules concerning those who are terminally ill with their death foreseeable and imminent, and those who are suffering unendurable long-term pain but are not actually terminally ill. The Canadian law has sort of expanded its scope over the period from 2016 to the present day. Many Canadians, it seems, now are somewhat worried that as it stands, the rules around assisted dying essentially give a signal to the country that enduring disability is now a sort of qualifier for euthanasia. Is that fair comment?
I think it's a little bit inaccurate, to be honest. And I think context is important. I think we need to remember that the original High Court decision. The change in our laws didn't come because patients demanded it or the government thought it was a good idea. This was a constitutional challenge. It's a rights-based issue in Canada, which is quite unique. And it determined that the blanket prohibition of assisted dying in all circumstances was infringing on certain people's rights in certain circumstances. And in that decision, it's important to note that that court decision did not require a link with end of life or a terminal illness. The government imposed what they called reasonably foreseeable death, which was never meaning terminal illness. That's never been an issue or an eligibility criteria in Canada, which was put in place in 2016 by the government. That was felt to go against the court decision and challenged in the courts. And in fact, our courts in 2019 verified that that was in fact constitutionally invalid and removed it from our law. So we've never required terminal illness, and we don't now, though we do have a path for those whose death is reasonably foreseeable with no particular time frame around it. and those who are not. That in mind, it doesn't say that just because you're enduring disability that you qualify for an assisted death. There are many things that need to be true. A serious illness, disease, or disability is one thing that makes up the definition of a grievous and irremediable condition. Patient also needs to be in an advanced state of decline in capability or function, but, and needs to be suffering intolerably.
No, and you're outlining it very clearly, but there are people in Canada today who say that the fact is that some people severely disabled with different kinds of conditions, which are really giving their life enormous pain and difficulty, they turn to assisted dying simply because the healthcare and economic situation they are living in Canada today is not able to improve their lives to a point where life would be endurable. And they say, you know, rather than offering these people the chance to die, what we should really be doing is entirely focusing our attention on fixing the problems around their healthcare and their economic situations, which would give them a better quality of life.
Yeah, I think we absolutely need to recognize that there are social inadequacies. We have done terribly, like many countries. Canada has not lived up to its promise in terms of community mental health services, disability supports. Some areas don't have palliative care. We need to do better in housing, in income stability. All of these things are real problems. And I stand loudly and proudly with anybody who is demanding better. I can't do my job properly if I can't offer these things to my patients. Federal law requires me to make my patients aware of the available means to reduce their suffering, including all of those resources,
right,
to offer those to my patients and to make sure that they seriously consider them. So if they don't exist, it's very difficult to do my job. On the other hand, Stephen, if those things don't exist, we can't hold individuals hostage to society's failings. What we need to do is do better in those issues. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't allow assisted dying for people who are suffering intolerably a system that can't adequately help them.
But there is a difficult question about prioritization here. And one case that raised it was this case, I'm sure you're familiar with it, of the four Canadian veterans who in the autumn of 2022, it seems, were offered the possibility of assisted dying by a caseworker who looked at their individual circumstances. One of them, it seems, was quite a well-known Paralympian, Christine Gauthier, who said she was offered the option of dying by this healthcare employee after she said that she didn't have a wheelchair ramp, in her home and was struggling to get one installed. That's terrible. That's so shocking. How can that happen in Canada?
Well, it's ludicrous. I agree. And I think that you mentioned it was a caseworker. I don't understand why a caseworker at Veteran Affairs would be bringing up the issue of assisted dying with anybody, whether in person or on the telephone. Clearly, somebody has stepped out of their lane. It's not their job to do so. It's not their ability to do so. They have no professional responsibility to do so. That is just a ludicrous error.
In some countries, like, for example, in the state of Victoria in Australia, where euthanasia in certain circumstances is legal, there is a rule which says that no professional involved in care can initiate a conversation about assisted dying. But that is absolutely not the case in Canada, is it?
Right. So I agree that it shouldn't be the case. And we're going to talk about clinicians and in the therapeutic relationship. No caseworker at a government agency should ever be bringing it up. That I absolutely agree with. And that is clearly a ludicrous error that somebody made. But I think in the circumstances when a clinician is dealing with a patient, it is my professional obligation to offer all options to a patient when they are available. So if I have a patient who requires chemotherapy and I know of three regimens, but I only offer one, I am professionally liable for not doing my job. I think if a patient is in a specific situation and talking about end-of-life choices and exploring their goals of care and their discussions about what they want and don't want, talking about palliative care and talking about what is available, it would be professionally obligated for me to say something along the lines of, Some people in Canada are interested in hearing about assisted dying. It is newly available. Is that something you want me to discuss with you? I think you can ask permission and raise an issue in a professional way, in a compassionate way, and the patient will guide that conversation. To not be able to do so is to not be able to do my job in certain prescribed circumstances. Outside of that circumstance, it should not be happening.
In absolute numbers, Canada now has the highest number of deaths by different forms of assisted dying in the whole world, more than 10,000 in 2021. Some doctors involved in this are now getting a little bit worried. I'm thinking of Dr. Madeline Lee, for example, who also works in this field, as you do. She is now worried. She says that the laws are too vague. She says, I don't think death should be society's solution for its own failures. I believe the Canadian populace, maybe even our legislators, are not now aware of who's been qualifying for assisted dying and who has been dying in this way. She's beginning to get very worried. Are you?
I actually very much respect Dr. Lee. I know her well. I work with Dr. Lee, and I respect her point of view, and I sincerely disagree with it. I think we have a very rigorous system with a number of safeguards and eligibility criteria that are being exceptionally well adhered to. I know the colleagues in my country that do this work. They do it carefully, conscientiously, and aware of the fact that if they get it wrong, they're liable criminally for jail. We have been very careful in the past 6.5 years. There's not been one charge against a clinician for doing this work in an abusive way or in any way that falls out of the system. And I think that speaks volumes.
But
I think
that there
are people who are concerned about the role of government in supplying the social needs, but that is different than the MAID program.
Now, just quickly before we end, the Canadian government is still wrestling whether to go for another expansion of the parameters of assisted dying to include severe forms of mental illness. Do you support that expansion?
It's not whether I support it. That's up to the constitutional experts in our country who have spoken. And in the court decision, they did not specifically exclude those with mental health disorders. The government did that in 2021 by temporarily excluding those with mental health disorders from accessing MAID. This is a matter of inclusivity. This is not an expansion of our law. This is a restoration of the rights of those with mental health disorders in severe and rare cases, that they also have the same rights as other Canadians to access this legal care should they qualify. So I think the context is important. Whatever the law says is what I will follow. It's not about whether I agree or not. The question is not whether it will happen, but how to do it safely. And we are currently grappling and learning how to do that.
Canada right now is seen really across the world as the place with the most liberal euthanasia assisted dying laws in the world. Do you think that is something that Canadians should be proud of, or something that right now Canadians need to think hard about and maybe even worry about?
I think that we need to remember that Canada has learned from other jurisdictions. We saw what was working in Europe and what wasn't. We saw what was working in the US and what wasn't. And we learned from that. We don't require terminal illness. We have clinicians who could administer the medications with still a very rigorous system. So I think Canadians are very supportive and very proud to have this care available to them. They're very grateful for that. And I don't think there's anything to be particularly concerned about in that.
Dr. Stephanie Green, thank you for being on Hard Talk.
Thanks for your time.